KSF 90.1 in Burnaby, British Columbia.
Good day. You're listening to Free City Radio. I'm Stefan Christoph. Thanks for tuning in. This is edition 324. The program this week is the final in a series of three special episodes looking at the Civil Society Summit on the AI industry. This was a critical gathering looking at the voices of labor activists, environmental justice activists, indigenous voices, artists, and many others to look at the impacts of AI on our communities, on the land, on the water, and basically to present a critical view at this time where we see a liberal federal government in Canada openly embracing AI data centers. This gathering was co-hosted by the Council of Canadians. And on the broadcast this week, I am going to be sharing some perspectives on an important panel that took place as part of this summit, this gathering. It is on AI systems' impact on migrants and the immigration process. We will hear from three different voices. Abdullah Daoud, who is the founder of the Refugee Center, a Montreal-based nonprofit who supports refugees and newcomers, supporting them through things like legal, employment, housing, and integration services. And so Abdullah, I think, offers some really important insights as to how AI systems impact migrants here in Canada. Also, we hear from Mustafa Hanawi, who is an author and community organizer with the Immigrant Workers Center. He is the author of Essential Work, Disposable Workers, Migration, Capitalism, and Class. And Gabriel Bergevin Estable, a research fellow in geography of migration, connected to the Canada Research Chair in Global Migration Dynamics. These are the voices that we'll hear in this section. So now we'll hear those perspectives.
So yes, I think in my area of work, which primarily deals with policy and also with refugee claimants, asylum seekers in Canada, the Centre Refugee is probably sees around 12 to 13,000 claimants a year, all of which need legal help. That is the number one ask about their claims. So we started a clinic back in 2017 with the primary focus of let's try to help as many people as possible at this stage of their claim or their migration process or the refugee claim in Canada, because if you're not capturing them at this stage, it becomes significantly harder for them afterwards, right? Mustafa can probably speak to that much better than I can. So now, I think to relate it to this topic, I can speak about so many problems, but to relate it particularly to this topic, we are seeing a government in the Carney government that is operating on this idea of deterrence. They're trying to install in people's heads that, hey, people shouldn't come here to seek safety, right? So if you apply for a visa application and you know you're a little bit dishonest just to get here to claim safety, then you shouldn't be here, right? We should try to focus on reducing asylum claim numbers, right? I mean, on a moral and ethical level, that's something else, but that's not a legitimate reason, right? That's not a reason to say, hey, we should try to just stop these people from coming. Over 80% of refugee claims that go to the Immigration Refugee Board of Canada are accepted. So 8 out of 10 people come here on legitimate needs so far that we know of to seek safety. And the other two could be for other reasons that they might not have had good access to legal representation. They might not have good documentation. They might have been not understanding the process. On appeals, we even have an extremely high acceptance rate, right? So this premise of we should have a stronger border act, right? So I don't know if anyone here heard of Bill C-12 that recently passed. It also goes on this idea of deterrence. It's this idea of let's limit the structures and the policies and the laws in any way possible, even if we're going to go against our own charter, which they have, right? Even there's under testimony or under statement, the previous Minister of Immigration, who was probably the mastermind behind C-12, has said that it'll probably go against certain constitutional rights. We need to set this precedent to stop people from coming. And baked into that idea is how our AI systems are now going to be used in the IRCC and the IRB, right? In reality, the bias is baked in, right? So when we see IRCC officers or CBSA officers and we say, okay, this particular case was done for profiling, and, you know, they'll chalk it off and be like, this is just one officer, you know? This is the data that these AI systems are feeding from to build and to triage what gets seen by the IRCC and the IRB and the CBSA and what doesn't, right? What's illegible and whatever's ineligible has to be reviewed, right? So now we're creating systems where we're trying to bake in the profiling. Now we're actually making it very clearly and evidently systemic. That's the premise in which I approach this. And also from a funding perspective, the ideas and the proposals that come to me now that try to use AI in ways that I think could be good, but also could be dramatically bad. And we'll get into that as well.
So in terms of the two issues, I mean, both I'll speak on the labor thing, but also in terms of immigration and the question of deterrence, I think, is not just keeping people out or the ability to come and seek safety, but increase the numbers of people you can actually squeeze out of the country, right? And, I mean, I think our immigration policy is never about how many people actually come to the country, but how they can be controlled, right? I mean, that's fundamentally the major aim of Canada's immigration regime, right? The numbers game is a bit of a theater, right? We see this in Quebec. We see this, you know, there's too many immigrants, and then Quebec turns around and says, well, actually, we need more temporary foreign workers, right? So it's always a question of how you can actually control migration, right? And so one of the ways that we see this question of deterrence, and I think one of the things that really relates to AI is sort of this idea that artificial intelligence will make things efficient, right? But we actually seen a gross amount of inefficiency, right? Like the wait times for many people who are here is turning Canada fundamentally into a prison on purpose, right? So one of your last options as a failed asylum seeker is what's called the humanitarian and compassionate application. The wait times in Canada can now range between 10 and 50 years to have your application accepted. So the idea is to squeeze people to that they're separated so much from their families for such a long time that essentially they'll just turn around and go home themselves. That this is fundamentally the aim, right? In practice and on the ground. And again, in synthesizing, right? Because the idea of our refugee system is on the individual basis of the claim, right? But you see internal notes, internal memos, sort of grouping stories, using that data, where people are coming from, are these legitimate or illegitimate asylum claims, you know, for the 2 out of 10 that aren't accepted, right? So particularly people coming from Francophone Africa have been lumped in with internal memos being like, these are illegitimate claims. So what is the basis that they're actually, you know, using AI to actually triage these claims and triage applications in general, right? And I think it's really to take away the very structure of our immigration system, which is the basis that every individual claim will be treated individually, right? As soon as you start using metadata or analytics or algorithms, then you strip away the very basis of our immigration system. Right. And I think that is a fundamental issue, and not baked in is not only bias, but also, you know, fundamentally, you know, racism, xenophobia, and to be able to bring in the ideal immigrant while trying to keep away the non-ideal migrant. Right. And on the issue of work, and I think this is something that is really important for a lot of immigrants and migrants, Amazon's closed, but, you know, a big issue for me personally and within the IWC is the way that AI is being used in the workplace as a supervisor. And one of the things that, you know, and writer Alessandro DeFanti actually, you know, talks about this is that, you know, humans are still cheaper than robots, right? And particularly migrant workers are still cheaper than robots. And so a company like Amazon, which never left Quebec, right? It's everyone's still receiving their packages, right? So even though it's physically gone, the AI, the algorithms, all of that remain in place, and the jobs have become worse, have become more precarious, and a lot of that is a result of artificial intelligence, the deployment of AI. And so Amazon is the second largest private employer on Earth, only behind Walmart. So 1.5 million people who work in their warehouses, who are delivering packages, and these aren't the subcontractors as well, are managed by algorithms and by artificial intelligence, right? So the world screams about Big Brother and surveillance and AI in China, but yet 10 hours a day, over a million people are managed by AI. And one of the things this creates and does, it totally evades the law. So the kind of surveillance that you see, so a few quick anecdotes. So inside Amazon, all the cameras are controlled by AI, right? They give reports to the supervisors every 6 minutes, and then are amalgamated at the end of the day and have the right to punish, discipline workers, right? So you can be suspended. A lot of the stories that you hear about Amazon, workers hiding in the bathroom, et cetera, the reason why workers do that, it's the only place that they can't put an AI camera is in the toilet. So when people who are overworked, underpaid, are trying to find a break, the only place you can hide is in the bathroom. But yet there's no regulation around AI. Workers are fired automatically through AI programs. Workers are given their tasks through these AI programs. So no one knows a worker is 60 with a bad back, but the AI program will say, do you know what? It's your turn to pick up the 30-kilo package, and you've only got 10 seconds to move that package from the conveyor belt into the right tote bag, right? The AI program doesn't know that. So it's taken away any responsibility from the supervisors and has caused a lot of damage upon workers, has disciplined workers, and has evaded the law. A lot of workers have, you know, that we work with lost their claims or have had their claims, you know, sort of challenged in the labor courts on the basis that AI is actually the supervisor. The supervisors aren't the supervisors, but it's actually the algorithm that's the supervisor, right? But the algorithm can't be seen as breaking the law, right? Or labor laws. So I think to me, in the way, and it's not just Amazon, right? Because Amazon's sort of the, you know, every employer looks to be the next Amazon. While employers might not have the amount of money to invest in those AI programs or algorithms, eventually it'll become cheap enough for them to be able to do so. So you're going to start seeing what Amazon has deployed across workplaces, right? And we're beginning to see that more and more and more. And yet there's no stop and ask that this is forms of harassment. This is breaking our health and safety laws. This is undermining our basic, you know, basic labor standards, right? But there isn't that discussion on that scale. And unfortunately, even with the closures of Amazon, we didn't have that discussion here in Quebec. So to me, I think the way that it's being used in workplaces, especially in low-wage workplaces, is fundamental. And I don't think it's about replacing labor, but it's about making it more controlled and exploited, right?
I think one of the key takeaways I want to bring is that there's a severe deficit in transparency at how the government is using AI. And one of the ways that this plays out right now is that we are always a step behind right now. Like the process that we carried out to get access to information documents, it certainly gave us a lot of information, but it came in 2 years late or 3 years late. They were already moving on ahead to the next steps of their implementation by the time we got the data, and then by the time we analyze it and then spread the results. Not only has IRCC moved on to more and more robust AI solutions, and they're more entrenched in that pathway, it's going to be harder to get them to reverse the steam, but they're being emulated by other institutions now. So, and I think we need to increase a lot of our awareness and be very intentional about how we think about AI and migrant rights in particular. You know, the Refugee Center and the Immigration Worker Centers do super important on the ground frontline work with migrants, and I've seen it a lot over the years. I want to think about like more broadly, and not just the people here in this room, but more broadly in the Canadian society. Most Canadians have not gone through a migration process. They're not intimately aware of how it works, the same way that they are aware of how it works to interact with the state when they file their taxes or renew their driver's permit. When you look at internal reports at IRCC of error rates in the work permit renewal program in 2019, 2020, those error rates were around 25% of refusals were refused by error. So people went out of status, no longer allowed to work, and one in four of them had been refused by error based on their own internal audits. I don't think we can imagine any other public sector service that's provided direct to the population where a 25% error rate would not be front page news and political priority of the moment, something to be fixed right away. But because it happens to migrants, because there's no transparency about these kinds of mistakes, that are being integrated into the workflow more and more with AI and automation technology, there's no conversation. There's no broader conversation happening about them. So we need to be very intentional about understanding, especially for settlers, colonizers, people who were born with citizenship, who didn't have to go through the immigration process to understand what it can represent in people's lives, and also ask for our elected officials to be more accountable. Almost all MPs devote at least one staff member full-time to immigration casework. So it's actually super easy for a federal MP to get briefed on what works and what doesn't. It's just that maybe they don't get asked that much to be knowledgeable on these issues. We even see MPs sometimes on the immigration committee at Parliament who don't properly understand the immigration programs. So we need to ask more, I think, of our elected officials. We need to ask more of ourselves and our fellow members of our society in terms of understanding how the immigration system works, and ask for more transparency about how AI is used. I just want to, maybe just one last thing, is that Canada's destination state for migration, like even if there's been a reduction with the new administration in terms of deterrence, as you named it, overall it's still one of the countries, it used to be in the top 10, maybe it's still in the top 15, I haven't looked at last year's global rankings, but it's still very high in terms of a destination. We're not in the top 10 or top 15 in terms of population, but we are in terms of a destination for immigration. And Canada's economy, right as it's structured, really depends on like having migrant workers' bodies here on the ground doing lots of hard work with bad conditions. The immigration system is designed to bring those people in, but also trying to find ways to prevent those people from accessing a full regime of rights that other people in Canada benefit from. There's lots of ways to do it, but there used to be a lot of tension between those two aspects, and a lot of these things are resolved in the courts. But more and more, they are using strategies of risk profile prediction to identify potentially problematic migrants in the application process and then find ways to exclude them from getting an application approved or delay them from having the application even processed so that if they can't find a legal way to refuse them, they can just stall them out of the country by having extremely long processing times. When we think of Canada's history about, for example, ships of asylum seekers that were turned back, which are very sorry episodes of Canada's country, our AI systems that are looking through visa applications and triaging them are looking, amongst other things, for people who are at risk of applying for asylum. And they're pinpointing individuals who have different travel plans from different countries and finding ways to flag them for officers to potentially refuse the applications. They're not turning back one ship of people, so it's not a spectacle that will be on front page news, but every day they're refusing people for these kinds of reasons in much larger numbers than have ever come to Canada on any single ship. So we need to think more, be more aware of how these AI systems are reproducing the exact kind of dynamics that we don't want to see, but in more hidden ways. And then we need to request a lot more transparency from our government to be able to do that.
Right. Thank you for this first round. So, Gabrielle, you already started talking about methods. So I'd like to dig into methods. And methods are important for researchers, for activists, for workers, for everyone who is engaged in resisting AI. And so I'd like to ask you all, how do you examine, study, organize around the impact of AI on migrants and immigration issues? So how do you do it?
In terms of research methods, there's actually a lot. I'll speak for our team. We've been, first we requested a lot of ATIP documents, access to information and privacy. So it's freedom of information in the US, has other names in other countries. You write to the government and you tell them, I hear that you have a document on this topic. I would like to have a copy of it, please. And then they'll censor out the things that they can't release for security reasons or whatnot. And then they'll provide you whatever's left of the document. Obviously, some of the documents that we have the table of contents and then everything else is empty. But a lot of the documents are actually very interesting, full of details. You can get emails also. You can ATIP emails between different public servants. So you can look what they're emailing about, the meetings they're scheduling, what's the on the agenda for the meeting, things like that. So it's very boring stuff. It's fascinating when you find exactly what you're looking for. We're also doing, we did a round of interviews with people working in community groups, lawyers, immigration consultants, and staffers in MP offices about how, in the way that they help migrants interact with the administrative state, how they've seen changes with the introduction of AI and automation. For us, the next round is going to be interviews with public servants, seeing how their work has changed with the introduction of AI in their workplace.
For me, methods are split into two. When it comes to, like, I guess the more activist work, it really depends on what we see happening on the ground, right? So I'll give an example, a more recent example. With the passing of Bill C-12, the Centre Réfugié, we saw, I mean, they announced it also publicly, but 30,000 letters went out, about 33,000 letters went out to all asylum seekers that now they're no longer eligible, right? Because of this new policy. And one of these new policies that they introduced was, you know, if you've been in the country for more than a year from your first point of entry, so you could have came as a kid, left, came back later, claimed asylum, because it's been more than a year, you're ineligible, right? I'm sure everyone can think of a thousand reasons of why that's grossly unethical. But you know, when we quizzed officials as to why, how come, like, did a lot of these letters came out of nowhere? A lot of these letters didn't actually apply. A lot of letters went to people who are exempt from this, right? It was automated. It was like, okay, there was an algorithm that went in, saw dates of entry, saw this, made an automated decision, 33,000 letters went out, right? With zero repercussion as to the actual cases involved, right? Which then goes back to my previous point. This is the intention, you know, the veiled intention. I'm not so veiled anymore. Of the current government and its practice and what it needs to do. The method of how to, and this is the unfortunate reality, is that it's tough. Policy always catches up to these realities, right? Whenever a new disruptive technology comes in, right? And disruptive is just like a sexy word for like extremely illegitimate and probably like human rights breaking and labor breaking type of technological interventions, right? The policy is reactive. The only time we see proactive policy is when the actual government officials themselves have their own intention to bring something on, and then they create the policy to create the to create the pathway for these things to happen, right? But from I guess from a community perspective and from an activist perspective, it's tough to be proactive in these things. But one very good tool of proactive policymaking is looking, and this is the good thing that's happening today in the world, is how interconnected we are, is looking where similar countries have tried this and failed, and why. There's been the use of AI. So when we look at AI, it's a broad term, right? There's a lot of things that aren't AI that they say are AI. There's a lot of things that are AI they don't say is AI. But in this particular case, when we talk about decision making or generative AI that makes its own reasoning to conclude something, right? Usually using machine learning or huge data sets. We look at a country, for example, like the Netherlands. So the Netherlands introduced this system. Basically what it did, it was, hey, we want to root out welfare fraud and residency fraud in the country. And we're going to do this based on previous data sets of our immigration officers making these decisions, right? Almost immediately, it targeted the most low-income, vulnerable populations in the region. And it had such a horrendous outcome rate in terms of the amount of people accused of these things to the amount of them people who are actually guilty of those things. It went all the way to their high court. They got overturned and it got banned almost like within a year of its use. So these algorithmic tools that, again, like I said, that bake in this profiling, bake in these biases as racism, as discrimination.
This has been another edition of Free City Radio. And we've heard voices from the Civil Society Summit on the AI industry. That was a gathering of activists, climate justice organizers, indigenous voices, and artists to look critically at the impacts of AI on labor, the environment, water, and our society at large. It was co-convened by the Council of Canadians, and I was happy to be there to document and record the event. You can visit aicivilsociety.ca for more information. This has been another edition of Free City Radio. We air weekly on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal on Wednesdays at 11 a.m., on CGLO 1690 a.m. also in Montreal on Thursdays at 8 a.m., on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg on Tuesdays at 8 a.m. and Fridays at 1:30 p.m., on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston on Wednesdays at 11:30 a.m., on CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria on Saturdays at 7 a.m., on Met Radio, 1280 a.m. in Toronto on Fridays at 5:30 a.m., on CKCU 93.1 FM in Ottawa on Tuesdays at 2 p.m., on CJSF 90.1 FM in Vancouver on Tuesdays at 4 p.m., and on CHMA 106.9 FM in Sackville, New Brunswick on Tuesdays at 10 a.m. You can find our archives at soundcloud.com/Free City Radio. We're also a podcast. Look us up. Just search Free City Radio. I'm Stefan Christoph. Thanks so much for tuning in to this week's edition.